I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fidel, co-founder of Nest Labs, a company that makes smart digital assistants for the home. Their first project, the Nest Learning Thermostat, launched to consumers in fall of 2011. Prior to founding Nest, Tony spent 9 years at Apple. He was the senior vice president of Apple's iPod division, which oversaw the development of the iPod and iPhone. He served as a special advisor to Steve Jobs until late 2009. Tony previously worked as the chief technology officer at Philips. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thanks, Jessica.
Tony, you grew up going to 12 schools, is that right?
Yeah, I went to 12 schools over 15 years.
Why did your family move around so much?
Well, my dad was in sales at Levi Strauss, the jeans company, and we would move wherever the company wanted him to start new business, new sales, or primp up sales in those areas.
Was there any sense that you might want to do the same?
And my dad would always encourage me. He was like, I love it. He loves his job. He loves the relationships with the people that he worked with. But at the end of the day, he would say, use your mind. Use your mind. Don't use your hands. Use your mind. Mm-hmm. And luckily, you know, where I am now, I'm using my mind and my hands.
From an early age, you had encounters with technology and had a fascination with how things worked. What are your earliest memories of that?
Well, I think my first memory of just, you know, kind of building things and understanding things was through my grandfather. My grandfather would put me in harm's way, so to speak, when I was 4 or 5 and say, hey, change this electrical switch. Let's build a birdhouse. And then ultimately, when we would move away from him, then I would go and take apart old tube televisions and various other products around the house just to see how they worked. I didn't know much, but I was just curious, you know, take it apart, see what's going on.
You mentioned your grandfather. Is this your paternal grandfather?
Yeah, my mother's father.
Half your family is from Eastern Europe. Your paternal side is from Lebanon.
Yes.
What influence did Lebanon or Russia have in your upbringing, if any?
Well, food, number one, right? Mm-hmm. So we would have pierogi on one day, and the next day we would have, tabbouleh, and it would go back and forth. So holidays were very mixed, both Christian background families. But both families were fully Americanized at that point. But there were still, you know, those great aunts and uncles that would come and tell the old stories. And, you know, you would have Russian being spoken or Arabic being spoken. Unfortunately, I didn't learn any of those languages. But it was just a nice influence.
Given that you came from an immigrant family, was there any sense of, like, just having to hustle and be entrepreneurial at all or pioneering?
For me, I always saw my grandfather working. I saw my mother working, my father working all the time. And so that was just a normal thing. You know, when we would, on the weekends, we would be cutting the lawns together, right? We would be building something. We'd be repairing something. You were always doing something, fixing a window.
When was your first encounter with computers or with the technological world?
I think this was in 1979. Mm-hmm. I took a first summer school course. I didn't know what these computers were, but I said, I'm going to take some computer class. And it turned out to be an IBM 360 mainframe somewhere far away in a paper terminal. And I just started using paper punch cards and doing basic programming. But also my father being in sales and he was like an early telecommuter, Levi's adopted a lot of technology very, very early for the salesmen, these remote salesmen. And so he would actually have these terminals that you would put your telephone on top of, and you would type things to place orders and things. And so I got this kind of sense that things are coming.
So your first computer was an Apple II when you were 12 years old. Do you remember how much it was?
Oh, absolutely, because actually, this is the case where my grandfather doubled whatever I made that summer to help me buy a computer. He didn't know what it was, but because he was a carpenter and also a superintendent, he knew tools were very, very important to do the next thing. So he saw this as a tool, and he's like, I don't know what it is, but you really want it, so I'm going to go halvesies with you, but you just have to earn all that other money. So I worked incredibly hard that summer. He matched it, and I got the Apple II. I think it was about $2,700. That was a lot of money back in those days.
What did you do with it?
really, for me, I started programming because that was actually a culture. You know, you might know of Make Magazine today. Make Magazine, you open it up and you can do all these different hacker-like things. Well, back then, there was Apple Insider and there's some different other magazines like that, Insight Magazine. And they actually had programs in there so that you could learn from those programs. I would type them into the computer and see what they did and dissect them. And so I was able to literally learn to teach myself programming through those magazines and books.
You were an avid self-starting learner, it seems. How were you as a student in school?
I was very good at the things I was interested in. And the other things that bored me, you know, I was not necessarily a great student. I only did things that I was very curious in. And so in the case of computer class, because I had already done computers, I went to computer class. And literally in that class, I would try to teach the class. And obviously, that was much the chagrin of the teacher. And at the end of each of those classes, I was almost thrown out every single time. So, you know, it's let's put it this way. I was not very contained.
Another interest of yours was music growing up.
Growing up in Detroit, yes.
What kind of music and where did that start?
Well, I think it first started when I was young, probably in second or third grade. We had next-door neighbors in Rochester, New York. And those neighbors were in junior high and high school. And I don't know why they wanted to hang out with us, but they did. And I would listen to, bands like Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith back when they were really in the day. And I was like, these are wonderful. And from that, I just started learning about music. My family was really not musical, but my brother and I, we just awoke to that.
You've worked as a DJ from time to time.
So yeah, it was, nothing like you would think of a DJ today. Mm-hmm. I'd literally take my music out and people would go, oh, I like that. Could you play for this party? Could you play for that party? And so I just got to getting bigger and bigger events and doing different things for friends. And it was just a hobby for me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fadell, co-founder of Nest Labs, a company that makes smart digital assistants for the home or office. Tony previously worked at Apple, where he oversaw 18 versions of the iPod and 3 versions of the iPhone. He served as a special assistant to Steve Jobs until late 2009. You graduated from the University of Michigan, and your first job was at a company called General Magic, which was a spinoff of Apple.
Yes, absolutely. There were a few people who left Apple to create, and Apple was one of the first investors in General Magic. But the founding team were the initial engineers and marketers that did the Macintosh in 1982, 83, 84. So I wanted to go and work with my heroes, the people who really knew how to build computers and the things that I loved. I wanted to go learn from them.
And when you left there to join Philips, you had plans for a new generation of hardware devices. How seminal was General Magic in your own development?
Well, it was amazing on many different levels. Number one, on engineering and just learning how to engineer and design products from the best minds in the time. So we got to do that. And then I also learned about partnering and how to try to work with companies all around the world. And I was only 21, 22 at the time, so I got to learn about how to work with these different companies to try to build a technology platform. Then also with marketers like Joanna Hoffman and people like that who could then tell the message out to consumers and see if we could get them to buy. So I also learned what not to do. General Magic was a huge flame out. It tanked. We probably sold, I think, maybe 10,000 devices for a company that had almost $500 million invested in 1992, 93 timeframe. But remember, at General Magic, what we were doing, we were creating what was a precursor to the iPhone, just 20 years ahead of its time.
So was the fact that you were too early and that the market wasn't ready for it, was that the major contributor to the company's demise? Or what other factors were there?
I think, there were too many features. There was too much technology, and there wasn't necessarily a market that could understand it yet because we were so far ahead. And then the internet occurred, right? All of these came together and it unraveled very quickly. And so we found a lot of our initial engineers and a lot of our team, they went off to be the founders of eBay. right, and Web TV, and all kinds of other incredible companies all around Silicon Valley. And in some cases, there one reporter said that General Magic was the greatest startup that had to die, right, so that we could, it could let all of these different flowers bloom.
While other colleagues were going to eBay and other startups, you went to Philips, which had more than 260,000 employees, and you started the mobile division within Philips. And at the time, you were 25 years old. Talk to me about that experience.
Sure, absolutely. So at General Magic, I saw this this amazing wealth of technology that was created over a span of 4 or 5 years. Kind of languishing. And I said, there's got to be some great things we can do with that technology. And I started creating my own product, what I thought we could use this technology for. And I took it to General Magic, and they said, you know, the die is cast. We have this roadmap. An interesting thing. Maybe we'll do it one day. Mm-hmm. And that frustrated me because I could see we were not heading down the right path. And specifically, I reached out to Philips Electronics through my contacts there. And they got me a meeting with the CEO of Philips and I pitched him this product.
What was the product at the time?
The product ultimately turned out to be one of the very first Windows CE devices. It was called the Philips Velo, and it was what we call like a billfold like product that had a little keyboard and a little display and a modem, so that you could do emails from wherever you were and take notes and do spreadsheets. It was a very critically acclaimed product, one of the best of its kind at that point, and that was born out of my time at General Magic. And I was just lucky enough at that age to learn about how to build that kind of product and build a team. And learn how to be actually a true leader inside of a large company.
And speaking of leadership, it wasn't uncomplicated. You would say that when you would get excited, you would get loud. What exactly, what did you mean?
Well, you know, I'm naturally an animated character. And so when I was passionate about something, I would raise my voice. I would start flailing my arms. And I would like, we have to do this. You understand? And so it was this... sometimes it was called youthful overexuberance, and because I just really wanted these things to happen, and when I grew into a leader, it took some time. I learned that my voice and the way I carried myself would amplify, and I learned that kind of thing wasn't so great, you know, because you needed to be a rock steady leader all the time. I think for the leadership role I was given, I had to grow into those shoes. And I grew as fast as I could. There was one funny thing, which was the team. They hung a big siren and flashing light above my desk. And whenever I was in the office, they would flip on the siren and say, Tony's in the office. And so everyone knew, like, oh, Tony's here, watch out. But it was all in jest. It was a lot of fun.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fadell, co-founder of Nest Labs. We'll hear more from Tony coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fadell, co-founder of Nest Labs, which makes the Nest Learning Thermostat. Prior to starting Nest, Tony spent 9 years at Apple, where he led the team that built the iPod and the iPhone. He was a special advisor to Steve Jobs until 2009. You finally left Philips, and you started your own company called Fuse in 1998.
That's correct.
What was the ambition for Fuse? What was the idea behind Fuse?
Well, I had seen this digital transition occurring in the home. We were looking at HDTV coming into the home. I had now experienced MP3s for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, and MP3 is the digital audio file. And I thought, as the world becomes more and more digital inside the home, where are people going to buy these things? And so I was envisioning creating the Dell of consumer electronics, literally somewhere which you could go online in the internet to buy a home theater system that would be fully configured for you.
What was the response from companies and from venture capitalists?
It's a great question. So given my track record, I was able to pull in money from people who trusted that we knew what we were doing. And so we were aligned with Samsung at the time. We were I had a few other angel investors, and we got started. And we were doing really well in terms of defining the vision, but it was going to take another set of capital to really pull this off. The internet boom was happening. This was 99, right? No one wanted to do anything with hardware. They're like, hardware? This is crazy. You just want build a service, you know, an internet service, cheap, easy, 10 people. Don't waste your time with this. And I said, no, I think this is really important. And then the internet bubble happened and it burst. And we ended up not having any chance to get any money, regardless of whether we were an electron company or an atom company. And so we were languishing.
And what was going on in your own personal life at the time?
So personally, I was working day and night trying to get Fuse off the ground. I think I made 85 different VC pitches to try to raise the money.
Why not try to innovate this product also inside of Philips? What was the catalyst for leaving Philips?
I think the first one was is I just wanted my own company. I had learned a lot at Philips about we could build anything, but can a company actually sell it? At the end of the day, the people who were entrusted to sell and market it, they didn't understand the product. We had a tough time when we said we have a PDA. People are like, well, we don't have a place for PDAs in the store.
Right.
We don't know how to sell these things. Mm-hmm. And so Philips decided they'd rather sell TVs than our stuff.
You have a very acute engineering acumen, but you also seem to have overlaid that with a real business sense as well, which it seems unique to have both coexisting.
It was a learned skill. I think a lot of sales and marketing came from my dad and watching what my dad did at Levi. But then also, I saw the failure of General Magic. I also had my own startups along the way. And so it just developed over time, and I was able to use the technology as my way of the foot in the door because that would be my differentiation.
Incidentally, one of the companies you went to during this challenging period when Fuse wasn't getting off the ground was Real Networks, where you had a brief stint for about 6 weeks prior to going to Apple.
Yes.
And some say that your transition to Apple was a turning point in the digital music evolution to some degree. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. You know, it's undeniable that the iPod and iTunes and then the iTunes Music Store and then obviously became the iTunes Store has changed the music business, the video business, and movie business.
I guess my question is sort of the counterfactual. Had you stayed at Real Networks, would the evolution or revolution taken place, could it have taken place in Real Networks versus Apple?
I think that Apple has some very unique characteristics, being that it touches every part of the consumer experience, hardware, software, now retail. Real Networks was more of a technology company and more of a software company who was going to partner with hardware companies to get some of these things done. So I think that having the, as we call, whole widget thinking underneath one tent is incredibly important for the rapid evolution that happened that the iPod and iTunes brought to the marketplace.
Okay. So finally, you left Real Networks and you knocked on Apple's door.
They knocked on my door, actually.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
So while I was at Fuse and we were going through these difficult times, I decided I had to just clear my head for a little while and I went skiing for a couple of days. And as I'm on a chairlift in Vail, I got a call from John Rubinstein, mm-hmm. who was the senior vice president of hardware at Apple. And he said, hey, we'd love you to talk to you. We'd think about you as a consultant to come and work on this new idea we have. And lo and behold, that ultimately, you know, 6 weeks later, I created the initial model and all the block diagrams and spreadsheets and all the things necessary to justify this product. Being the iPod that ultimately then, you know, 10 months later shipped to the world.
It's been said that you are the godfather of the iPod or the father of the iPod or what would you call yourself? I know you're going to say it's a whole team of people, but what would you tell your kids?
I would say that I was a major force in making it a reality, but it took a team of people all around me to do so. But I was very passionate. I'm passionate about music. I was passionate and still am about portable products. And so it wasn't just and Apple wanted to get something new out. So it was the environment. It was the people. And it was myself really all driving ahead saying we need to make this happen.
So when you did get the call from John Rubinstein, where was Apple at that moment in terms of creating the iPod? Were they far along in saying, okay, we want a personal device for music, or is that where you came in?
So as it was described to me at the time was that iTunes had just shipped about 2 months earlier, and iTunes was a phenomenal music player, but it only worked on a Macintosh. And you could rip your CDs and play them back and create CDs on it. But they wanted to bring that music onto a Walkman-like product. So they said that was the frame. Now, what could you do, given this context? Why don't you work with Jeff Robin and figure out what could be built?
There are so many versions about the early days of the iPod, and you know everything was behind such closed doors and behind these secret walls that Steve wanted to develop. Were you surprised by this level of secrecy that Steve created in the culture?
In some ways, no, I wasn't, because at General Magic, the culture was based on what they had done with the Mac, right? And so they had a super secret culture in the Mac. We had a super secret culture at General Magic. And so for me, that was just the only way you did business. So coming to Apple was, it didn't seem extreme to me. And it's still odd for partners and people to go, why do you do this? But at the end of the day, I believe it is the right way to get things done.
You mentioned that secrecy is pretty critical, but secrecy is not ironclad, and there's always a leak here and there.
Absolutely.
So what good is secrecy ultimately?
Well, secrecy, you know, it's hard to know what you can talk about on a project with your friends or with your spouse or with partners. And so if you have a total culture of openness, everything moves around and all of your competitors and everyone will ultimately know, because Silicon Valley is a small place, or a certain business environment is a small place because people leave companies and join others. And so you have to say, look, this is about a team. It's about our ideas. It's about something that we're creating that no one ever has seen before. We have to cherish this. This is ours. And when we're ready to tell as a team what we're doing, we can have the maximum impact. That's when we want to do it. And so Silicon Valley engineers understand that.
One of the reasons Steve Jobs was focused on secrecy was he was always worried that his key employees would be poached by other firms. Here you have Matt Rogers now working with you, a former Apple employee and other Apple employees. And you did promise Steve that you would not make any competing products with the iPod. How do you view your starting a new company with your colleagues from Apple?
Well, to me, there's two things. The first one being, this is a free country. And you can look at it as when these people join your team, they're only yours and you can treat them any way you want. And there's another one, which is they are free people. And they can choose at will to join any company they want. And it's based on what the company can do for them and what they can do for the company. And it's a give and take. So my belief, after seeing both sides of this, is that I like the freedom is king, and it's up to the company and its culture to continue to retain those people. We will pay you competitive rates, but not ungodly rates. We are going to make sure that you have one of the coolest products that you could possibly be working on. You know, this anti-poaching thing and all that other stuff. I just don't think that's the right thing to do.
You ultimately spent about 9 years at Apple, most of which was overseeing 18 versions of the iPod and a few versions of the iPhone. At what point did you start to get itchy feet? Like, okay, I'm starting to think that I'd like to move on to my next thing.
Well, doing 18 generations of iPods, a lot of iPods. But, you know, my wife also worked at Apple, and she worked for Steve. And so the two of us were really, really, on a treadmill, just working all the time. And ultimately, we had kids. We had two boys, and they were, you know, just born and 1 year old. And we were looking at each other and going, we're never going to be able to buy this time back. So let's go and focus on them focus on the family, and then we'll figure out what's next after that.
How long after you started working at Apple did you get married to Danielle Lampert, who is your wife?
Yes. So my wife and I met about a year after I started at Apple, and then we were married 8 months after we met.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the co-founder of Nest Labs, a company that makes smart digital assistants for the home and the office, including the Nest Thermostat, which is their first product that they launched to consumers in fall 2011. How did the idea for Nest originate?
Well, my wife and I, we love the Lake Tahoe area, and so we decided that we were going to build a green home in Lake Tahoe, hopefully the greenest home that we knew of, as well as the most connected home. And through the process of design, through the process of learning about all the products in the marketplace, we found deficiencies, or I found deficiencies all over the maintenance and usability of your home. And I was like, this is crazy. There's got to be better products.
What were some of those?
So, obviously the thermostat was one. Mm-hmm. But another one was solar panels. And luckily, over the span of when we started the project to the time we had to really commit to the project, solar panels were revolutionized. But when we looked at the thermostat, it had not evolved at all in those 3 years of design. And so after I had left Apple, I found some time while, you know, I was thinking about what was next. And I was like, maybe I can design my own thermostat. And as I started to dig into the problem, I found out, wow, this simple thing is really hard to do. It's so hard, and especially to create one that would be for an iPod or an iPhone-like consumer. What is the next generation home going to look like when the interface to your home is always in your pocket or in your hand? That thermostat quickly turned into a smartphone in disguise. And so one day I went and said, honey, I think I know what I'm going to do next. I'm going to make a thermostat. And she goes, what? The iPod guy making a thermostat? I don't get it. And then after I explained about, you know, for 15 or 30 seconds about what the business looked like, she's like, you'd be crazy not to do it.
What is so innovative and special about the Nest thermostat?
If you look at the Nest, it's a hockey puck. It's about the size of a hockey puck with high-quality materials. And so when you look at it, you're like, whoa, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. It's something totally different. And it's really simple to use. And so we went around that user-focused design and included not just a beautiful product, but also one that learns. Before the Nest existed, the 250 million thermostats that are in the U.S. installed, less than 10% of them were programmed to save any energy at all. Now with Nest, because we have a learning algorithm that basically when you get up in the morning, you might set it to one temperature, you go to work, you set it to another, come back another temperature, and when you go to bed, you set it to a temperature. We watch those patterns, and then we just play those back for you. And 99% of all of our Nest thermostats have learned a schedule or programmed a schedule to save energy. Mm-hmm. We also have auto away built in. So we sense motion in the home. And when we don't see motion for a period of time during waking hours, we actually then turn down the temperature to something that you specify to say, I'm not here, save me energy.
Where did the name Nest come from?
back in the 90s, there was a show called MTV Cribs. You know, it was all about your house. And so I kind of riffed off of that with my friends. I would say, hey, come on back to my nest. Come back to my nest. Let's go listen to some music, have some food, what have you. And so that stuck.
You mentioned Matt Rogers, who's your co-founder, who actually started off as your intern at Apple.
That's right.
You brought him on board. And he said, you know, at some point he was kind of done with making toys for people, referring to the iPod. How much of your motivation for starting this Nest Labs and the thermostat is your wanting to do something that's more socially minded outside of, you know, making toys?
Well, Matt, actually, I'll have to be very honest, is Matt kept bugging me that we should do this project because I was like, I don't know, I'm not ready for a startup right now. I have kids and everything. And he was like, no, we must do this. So he was as driving a force, and that's why he's a co-founder, to make this happen. But once you have kids, to your question, you start looking at the world very differently. And when it was very simple to say, Here's an unloved space, a thermostat space. Tons of innovation can be brought to it. And by the way, ton of innovation that I know how to build. And by the way, we can save a lot of energy. How could I not do this?
So, again, you approached venture capitalists like in your Fuse days, but life has changed a little bit having developed the iPod. I assume raising capital was a piece of cake this time.
Yeah, it was a much, much different experience. It was more like, Tony, we know you're doing something. Let us give you money.
Right.
We did a great job. We have to do the right thing for our investors and prove that we have a business case. Mm-hmm. But we were able to basically get our money on a handshake.
What has been harder for you than you thought in the early days of Nest?
What's been harder? Well, I thought that there was going to be much more expertise in the heating and cooling business that we could draw upon. I knew it was going to be hairy and kind of scary to try to hook up to these 20 and 30 year old systems, because who knows what's out there? It's not like it's a typical USB port or some kind of standard that's out there. It's very, very wild and woolly. And so what we had to do is we went into 500 homes and looked at all of the different wiring combinations and built a team of industry experts, installers, mm-hmm. who know how this stuff works from around the country to help us design the product.
Incidentally, could you tell me a little bit about the time you spent between Apple and Nest traveling?
Sure, absolutely. We decided we were going to travel the world with the kids, and we lived in Paris for 6 months and put our son, our oldest son, into French public preschool. While we were living in Paris, we were literally a block away from the Louvre. Every time I'd go, I'd get inspired and learn about more artists. And I saw that they had different periods of their life, you know, Picasso's green period, Picasso's blue period, what have you. And they took some time off and they went and re-energized themselves and did something different. And so I was looking at it, mapping it onto my own life, going, what am I going to do next? And this is where, you know, I'm sitting on a bridge and I'm looking at the Louvre and I'm thinking of this thermostat idea. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to have a better idea. Let's make this happen. That's when I called up Matt. We moved on from there.
Did you become uber-focused on, well, what thermostats did they have at the Louvre when you were walking around?
Once you tune into a device that you've ignored for years and years and years, now you start looking. I see one here and I see one there. It just shakes me every time and I go, yes, ours is better. You see that light, the world in a whole new set of eyes.
It's like when you become pregnant, all of a sudden everybody around you is pregnant.
Exactly. I never saw kids before until I have kids.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been Tony Fadell, co-founder of Nest Labs. Coming up, we'll meet Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber, an on-demand app that allows you to order a car service using your mobile device. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an app-powered car service that helps connect drivers and passengers. The service is available in New York City, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Paris, among other cities. Travis started the company in 2010 with co-founder Garris Camp. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how does Uber work?
You get your iPhone or your Android device out, your smartphone. You push a button, and in 5 minutes, a town car arrives. You can see the car coming to you on the phone, and because you have a credit card on file with us, it truly is like your private driver, because when you get to your destination, you just walk out of the car. Mm. There's no vouchers. There's no tips already included. It's quite an elegant experience.
How did you come up with the idea?
Well, look, in San Francisco, it's very hard to get a cab. The original idea came from my co-founder was, I just want to push a button and get a car. And he's like, Travis, we should buy 10 Mercedes S-Classes, get 20 drivers, and lease a parking garage. And I said, Garrett, that is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. Now, the pushing the button and getting a car is actually pretty cool. But to be able to do that with just technology without going into owning cars and all that infrastructure was really a more efficient way of doing it.
So you had this idea. How serious was that partnership initially?
When we first got going with the business, it was really very much a lifestyle type thing. And basically, the idea was really this would be for maybe 50 of our friends or 100 of our friends. It used to be you had to get a code from me to become to be able to use the service. And you know, my email box started overflowing with people who wanted the special code, so we just opened it up.
Now, the service has been somewhat controversial for a number of reasons, one of which is that you exist outside the, you know, the medallion system. You have, for instance, New York City taxis. The drivers work very hard to buy a medallion, which is very valuable, and here you are competing with taxis.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, right, is that what a medallion is it's a license to own and operate a cab. In the city of New York, the number of licenses to own and operate cabs has pretty much been the same since the 1940s. That makes those licenses to own and operate a taxi very valuable. In fact, now they're going for about $1 million apiece. It's very rare to have a driver that actually owns a medallion. These are not millionaires driving cars. What it is that you have investors that own the licenses typically, and they run rental car companies, which we call taxi companies, that rent the car out to taxi drivers at the, you know, a cost. It can be like, you know, as an example, like $200 a shift.
The San Francisco Metro Transit Authority issued a cease and desist order.
That's correct.
What was their issue?
There are a number of concerns they had, but I guess in California, the way it works is that the cities regulate taxis and the state regulates limousines, right? The Public Utilities Commission, the guys who regulate your water and your power, also regulate your limousines. So a cease and desist from the city doesn't have a lot of weight when it comes to a company that, which is Uber, working with a bunch of permitted, licensed limo companies, which are regulated by the state. But the name of our company was Uber Cab, and they said, well, you're marketing yourselves as a taxi company. They have jurisdiction over taxi. And so we took the cab off.
Another part of the controversy surrounding Uber is this dynamic pricing, where as the demand for cars increases, so does the price.
Yeah.
And dynamic pricing exists with hotels and airlines. How did you decide to institute dynamic pricing initially?
Right. Dynamic pricing is what we institute when there's an extreme imbalance between supply and demand. And so everybody knows, let's say in New York, around shift change, like 4 to 5 p.m. or so, all the taxis then do it, you know, then go in and they switch out drivers. So right at the time when everybody needs a taxi is the time when there are no taxis around. And if we don't raise the price, our partners, which are limo companies, will go elsewhere because there is a surge situation. They can make money elsewhere.
Uber has a rating service where the customer rates the driver and vice versa.
Yeah.
What dynamic does that create?
What's interesting about Uber is that we are completely accountable and transparent. So you get a receipt when you're done taking a ride that shows the exact route that was taken, the speed, the distance. And in addition, when you're done with the ride, you rate the driver and the driver rates you. Because of that accountability, all actors in the system act much better. Drivers love it because the riders are acting, you know, civilized, and vice versa.
You have raised capital from a number of venture capitalists, one of which is Benchmark in San Francisco. Can you tell me about that initial encounter?
I had a partners meeting there right after I had a partners meeting with Sequoia. I had an Uber take me to Sand Hill Road and drop me off at Sequoia. And I was just going to hit the button to get the Uber back and take it a mile and a half down the road to Benchmark. I finished my Sequoia meeting, opened up my app, and my Uber wasn't there. I'm stressing out a little bit because I can't go and call Benchmark that I'm going to be late because my system that I'm pitching them isn't working. What I did was I started running. I had my dress shoes on. I had my bag with my laptop, and I started running down Sand Hill Road. And I ran a mile and a half down to Benchmark from Sequoia, was about 15 minutes late, was sweating, and I'm like, what's going on? They had called my Uber while I was at Sequoia and took it off the system. It was a prank. Anyways, the meeting went really well. This is pretty rare. They put me in a separate room after the partners meeting. They met, you know, they were talked about it for about 15 minutes, and they came in the room and they wanted to do a deal right on the spot. Now, I wasn't really going to let that happen. But the next day I get to my office and there's a box on my desk. And that box was a shoe box. And those guys had bought me running shoes. And so every once in a while I might tweet out or something like that, like I've got my Benchmark shoes on today.
And did they know that you were coming from Sequoia?
They probably did because the car was right outside of Sequoia, so they could open up their app and see the car there.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an on-demand car service that helps you find a car using your smartphone. You grew up in Los Angeles,
yep.
And your background is in computer engineering. You went to UCLA. You didn't graduate from there.
That's
but
correct.
Before starting college, you formed an SAT tutoring company. What were your SAT scores?
Let's just say they're really high. I think I was like 1580.
So did you start this company?
What happened was I started tutoring SATs in my summer between high school and college. And so it wasn't really a company at that point. But the first person I tutored went up by about 400 points. That's like going from community school to like a UC school, right? That's like a big deal. And pretty soon I was tutoring all the kids on the block, right? At some point, one of the fathers of one of the kids I was tutoring said, let's start a company.
How did you go about getting the clients?
The kid that I was tutoring was Korean background, right? And his family generally was, they went to a Korean church. And so the father, which basically was my business partner, would recruit all of the kids from the Korean church. And so I was the only white guy in the school. And I learned a lot about Korean culture, but it was just kind of an interesting story.
So you were a senior at UCLA when you started your second company called Scour, which was a peer-to-peer search engine technology.
Yeah.
And that was similar to Napster, which was the music peer-to-peer sharing service, although yours incorporated more multimedia platforms,
sure.
So video as well. Yeah. How did you come up with that idea?
So actually that was started by a buddy of mine, a guy named Vince Bussum. And so what happened was we would hang out at the Computer Science Undergraduate Association at UCLA, and we would do a few things. We would play Double Dragon. We would do these brain teasers, these like math brain teasers, and we would find MP3s on different FTP servers, and we would download and play them.
MP3 being these audio files.
That's correct. If you remember way back then, if you're on a Windows 95 machine, you could not, if you had a Windows shared folder and you put files in there, there was no such thing as a firewall. Mm-hmm. Anybody could get it on the internet. So we would crawl Windows shared folders across the internet everywhere. Mm-hmm. We'd index all these files, and we had a website where you go type something in, like Britney Spears or Green Day or whatever. And you would get the results, you'd click, and there'd be an application that would help you download these things. The problem is there are only so many sources. There's only so much supply for these files. Mm-hmm. And we got so popular that the demand was outstripping it and therefore crashing the machines that were serving these up. So people's machines would just crash without explanation because too many people were trying to connect to it sort of remotely. Sean Fanning, who is one of our users and the co-founder of Napster, was like, I can do better than this. And so what he did was he made it so that when you went and downloaded a file, that you would automatically share it. What happened in our system, you would get a file and maybe you put it in a Windows share yourself, but he made it where it automatically shared so supply and demand would go up together. And that's why Napster became Napster.
When you realized that Sean had this little innovation,
sure.
What was your reaction?
Well, our reaction was, we're going to do that too. Mm-hmm. So he one-upped us, and then we one-upped him, and it was like this sort of arms race of technology.
Would Sean Fanning tell a compatible story to what you're telling?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, Sean Fanning is an investor in Uber.
So just as Uber has faced a degree of controversy, Scour certainly had a tempestuous start. And part of that conflict came with your early investors, one of whom was Michael Ovitz, the founder of Creative Artist Agency, CAA, and the former president of Disney.
Yeah.
What happened there?
So Michael Ovitz did become an investor eventually. Prior to him becoming an investor, you know, we sort of go through the process of getting an investment, which includes a term sheet. And in this case, it was a letter of intent that essentially said we couldn't shop a deal. Now, we were pretty thin on cash, running out of it, so we needed to get a deal done, but the deal just wasn't getting done. So the LOI ran out. We didn't get a deal done. And I had to, we had to go and find money somewhere. But once it was clear that we weren't going to get a deal done with their side, we basically got sued. And that is public knowledge. That was in the Wall Street Journal. I'm not really sure how the Wall Street Journal found out about it, but it was published there. And when you get a Wall Street Journal story saying that you've been sued by a guy named Michael Ovitz, you are not going to get funding anywhere. So we had one option, and that was to do the deal with him, and that's what we did.
So you were sued by him because he accused you of shopping the deal, even though the letter of intent had expired.
That's correct.
And the litigation didn't end there because you were also sued by the media companies who said that you were facilitating the stealing of their content through your peer-to-peer file sharing service.
So look, these were the early days. Right now we have sites like YouTube where there's tons of content. It's hosted by YouTube. It's distributed. You know, YouTube was sued by the entertainment industry as well. It's just YouTube had a lot more money to fight that. Mm-hmm. So we got sued over at Scour for $250 billion. At the time, we like to say the GDP of Sweden. And we clearly didn't have that in our back pockets. And so we filed Chapter 11 as what we like to say a strategic move. The media industry did not want copyright law to be settled in bankruptcy court in a couple weeks. And so we settled with them for $1 million cash, turned the technology off, and sold the assets of the company for $10 million, which is about what we got in funding.
And what was your psychology at the time? Here you are, you're 22 years old. Did you certainly probably didn't expect to enter this level of turmoil?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was wild days. When you're 22 or 23 and you're going through this, you learn really quickly. But you also just come to accept that's how business is. And it wasn't until many years later that I realized that's not how it is.
And then after Scour, you founded Red Swoosh, which was a content delivery network, which had its own share of problems.
Well, here's the thing, right? So we created peer-to-peer technology at Scour. We got sued for it. We went bankrupt, and we had to start over again. So the idea for Red Swoosh was let's take that beautiful technology and take those 33 guys who sued us and turn them into customers with the same stuff they sued us for. When you turn it around and turn them into a customer, you say, look, peer-to-peer is really good at distributing data efficiently at low cost. So I'm going to allow a site, this we never worked with YouTube, but here's an example. Imagine going to YouTube, clicking on a link, and watching a video. But instead of that video being distributed over YouTube servers and over YouTube bandwidth, which is quite expensive, it would pull from 30 PCs that had already gotten that video content. And now YouTube, in this hypothetical situation, can save hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
And why was this period so challenging for you at Red Swoosh?
It's like I was 5 years too early to market. I started in like the Dust Bowl of the internet era, right, which was 2001. There's nothing going on. And I did 4 years without a salary. That harshness of basically, I like to say, I got 100 no's a day for 2,000 days straight, which is 200,000 no's, and you keep getting up. I still got customers, but I had to arm wrestle every single one of them to the floor to get them to do it. Mm. And it was just tough.
So now you have Uber, and life seems a bit easier than it was with your former companies. What do you see Uber becoming?
I like to say that FedEx delivers packages tomorrow. Uber delivers packages in 5 minutes. It just so happens that package is a town car that will take you wherever you want to go. But once you're delivering that package of the town car, you can deliver pretty much anything. And so we like to think that we're building an urban logistics fabric, right? A real-time supply chain. And I think that gives some sort of vision for where we think this can go.
Any interesting stories about, passengers or a story with a driver or something like that?
So our community guy, in San Francisco. He does all the customer support and a lot of the local marketing in San Francisco. He gets to see everything. I mean, we have a $200 puke charge, for instance. We do suspend accounts. That does happen. When we first do it, we say, look, we hear there was some activity that had occurred. We're going to have to suspend your account. And most of the time, people understand and they move on. Sometimes people go, it was a perfectly fine ride. I don't know what you're talking about. And then you respond by saying, well, there was some, you know, there was some word that you had done a drug deal and were attempting to solicit a prostitute while in one of our partner's cars.
And then
they usually don't say anything else.
So here you are a car service and a law enforcement service.
Yeah, we definitely don't think of ourselves that way, but there, you know, all the things that happen in the real world, you know, this is a transportation system. These types of things can happen. And so we have to just act, you know, responsibly in those situations.
So you have a $200 charge for people vomiting in your taxi. What about women breaking their water? I was rushing to the hospital to give birth to my first daughter, and my water broke in the taxi.
So there have been a number of Uber babies, and people tweet about it quite often. So a number of times where drivers have, you know, taken a woman in labor to the hospital. We've never had a baby born in an Uber. That would be a beautiful thing in my book. We would not charge the customer for that situation, but we may compensate the driver.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest has been Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.